Yeah.
Hey, you guys, welcome back to In the Mind of Frage, a podcast that's all about interviews, experiences, and entrepreneurs. I always like to say that my podcasts are anything goes to entertain and inspire. And what I mean by that is I like to tackle almost anything, any topic, any person on, because I always hope that what I can give back to you is that maybe together, if we take a deeper scratch off the surface, look at things, that we can begin to think differently. So hopefully you get that from these podcasts. Thanks for listening to part one with Rob Scheer. I got some terrific Facebook feedback. You can always follow me. It's Sarah Frazier. Just hit pages. Mike wrote to me and he said, Sarah, thank you for giving a fellow survivor a voice. It's important that we lift each other up so no one feels alone. Malesurvivor.org and or 1in6.org are both really fantastic resources if any men listened to this podcast and felt they needed support. So Mike, thank you for sharing that, and you can continue to share this podcast and comment on my Facebook page. Now for part two with Rob Scheer. He gets into, when you're raped by your parent as a child, do you even know it's wrong? Do you even know what's happening? We talk about that, and then we also get into Rob's decision to adopt with his husband Reese and why he didn't want to adopt through foster care. That's next. So they're going through, your mother, the woman that you call your mother, her husband, they're going through a divorce and separating. She also has other kids, right? Yeah. And so they end up, he basically says, I want you out. You're 18, yeah, Rob. Yeah, it doesn't matter that you're in high school.
Yeah, and they were together then. They weren't divorcing at that time. He, you know, he was the doting Mormon father who, you know, totally, you know, was the pillar of the community, he felt like. But the check was going to stop. And and so I became homeless. And I remember, I'll never forget it. I remember at that moment in my life that, again, here's a choice that I could have. I could be the statistic that everybody was expecting me to be, you know, drug addict, drop out of school, not amount to anything, or I can continue. And my biggest fear was that I was going to be put in a juvenile detention center, that I was going to be put in one of those places with those kids. And because I was a pretty good student, I was, you know, I was involved in the choir, and I, you know, I did the lead of all the plays, and I was a good kid. And so all of a sudden, my whole life changed, and I became homeless. And I didn't know what the hell to do. And so I remember, you know, I had a job at a little taco place, and the owner would keep the outside bathroom door unlocked for me to be able to go in and sleep there at night. I would have friends who would let me come and couch surf on their couch when their parents, you know, didn't know. I had one friend, Pam, like the month before I went into the military, her mom and dad let me stay in her basement. So, you know,
but during this time, there were people, there were teachers, there was the taco restaurant
owner.
They
knew about it.
People knew you didn't really have a place to stay.
I have a home.
And nobody said to you, come stay with us?
No, no. Not even my sisters or any of my relatives.
Have you done in your therapy and everything? Like, have you ever wondered why? Like, what? I mean, that's so crazy to me.
You know what? Let me tell you, I know why.
Why?
Because they had their own baggage that they had to deal with.
Wow. You think it was too much? It was like
too much for most people. It was too much for everybody. It was too much for everybody. Mm. I get it. I have no resentment. You know, the teachers that all gathered their money together and helped pay for me to go to New York on the senior trip because they knew I wasn't going to have that money.
Right.
They knew it. You know,
so you feel like people, I mean, I just have wondered, like, because you, of anybody, you have, I would think, the right to have some great resentments towards people because people have continually let you down.
That rips your soul apart. It did that for me for years. You know, I used to say all the time that my mother and my father and everybody was a product of their environment. Mm. They were not. They were a product of choices.
Wow. Okay? Wow.
And I had decided that the choice I was going to make was to forgive them and move on. See, if you truly are going to forgive somebody, you have to move on. So if I forgive them, and mind you, by me forgiving them doesn't mean I forget.
Right.
You know, doesn't mean that I excuse them. But what it does is it sets me free. It allows my soul to continue to grow without the baggage that they placed upon me. And that's, for me, what it was all about. You know? know.
God.
So but for me, it was an escape from all of that by forgiving them, you know. So the teachers and the principals and the ministers, the people, the neighbors,
the person that owned the taco store.
The taco place, you know.
Whenever I hear your story, whenever you and I talk, I'm like, God, I just like the taco guy. Like, yeah. I'm like, he knew
Steve
you were living.
Steve was amazing. He was amazing because at least he did something.
Right. He gave you food. He let you stay there.
He gave me a job. You know, I was, you know, 18 and, you know, I'm making $3.65 an hour and, you know, I would work some hours and, but, you know, I would do my schoolwork and, you know, yeah, it wasn't the best place to sleep in a bathroom, and the nights were scary. And
this story, too, like, you've just gone through so many horrific things because you're sort of on this pattern of being abused, being sexually abused, and that didn't stop. You were still...
No, I was still abused. I remember in the taco, because, you know, men knew that that was a bathroom that you could go to at night,
and there was this
18-year-old kid, and they, you know... And by that point in my life, it was just like I didn't care about myself, much less cared what someone was doing, you know.
What does that feel like? I mean, at that point, because you'd never known anything really different. So when you were being sexually abused, did you and your sisters, did you know that this was like what your father was doing to you was not normal?
I've asked my sister about that. I have one sister that I'm still, you know, really close to. Mm. Most of my other siblings have either died or they're in jail somewhere. So I hear from them when they want money, but that's about it. But I asked my one sister that, and she knew that it was wrong. And I said, you know, I knew that it was wrong, but there was a sense of warpedness in my mind that at least he was showing me he loved me.
Mm. Yeah, I'm sure.
You know, and so, gosh, to just think that that was okay for love is just disgusting. And, you know, it's taken many years to realize that, you know what, this wasn't my fault. And I used to think that all the time. What did I do wrong? What could I have done better? How could I have been a better son? How could I have been a better person? Maybe I was deserving this. And so, yeah, it was realizing that, you know what, I did nothing. These were his choices, you know, not mine.
So you're 18 years old. You'd been homeless that year of high school. You graduate.
Yeah, I graduate from high school. Scared to death, by the way. So when most kids were graduating from high school, they were excited. They were happy. By the way, guidance counselors were coming and pulling them out of, you know, the English class to go over college applications. Nobody ever did that with me, by the way. And I think that they just wanted to keep their head down and get me the hell out of the school because then they didn't have to worry about me. And so I graduated and I was like, what am I going to do? And the only thing I had the choice to do was to join the military. Mind you, I did not care about my country. Okay. They had let me down for 18 years.
Yeah.
I mean, the last thing in the world I cared about was anything to do with this country.
So no social worker ever showed up on your door.
No social worker ever showed
That's
up
amazing.
On my door.
That's amazing.
No. I mean, this is the thing that blew my mind, you know, and mind you, this is back in the 80s, you know.
Yeah, sure, right.
And I'm going to give that some, you know, weight to it. But, you know, again, I wasn't that kid. I wasn't the kid that was being arrested for shoplifting. I wasn't the kid that had D's and E's on his report card.
I know,
wasn't that kid that was smoking and was hanging out in the smoking area and being suspended. I wasn't that kid. So because I wasn't that kid, I didn't get that attention. And so now, as I look back as an older person, I can see why kids do some of the things they do.
Right.
Because they want that attention.
Right. It's a cry for help.
It's a cry for help. And I didn't give that. I never had that because I didn't give off that. I gave off that, I got this. You know?
Wow.
And so I joined the military. And, gosh, that was, you know, crazy. You know, but
and
I did.
You were only there for a short period of time.
Short period of time. So when I was a little boy, my father, one of his ways of control, he would say, you know, if you go to the bathroom without asking me, he'll beat me. So if I would pee, he would beat me. And he would say things like, you never see people go to the bathroom on TV.
Wow.
And that was his big thing, I remember. And so after so many years, you just hold your urine so much. And I did that. You know, that finally my bladder ruptured and I was in the Navy and they did surgery, fixed my bladder, and then discharged me. And that was unbelievable because, again, guess what? I became homeless. I had enough money to live in a hotel in a little town that I found called Gore, Virginia, because it had a week, you could pay by the week, and I had enough money. They flew me to Dulles Airport. I hitchhiked from Dulles Airport to Gore, Virginia, which was about 45 minutes south, and I lived in this hotel. I got a job at what they called a DART back then. It's like a Target, and I went to the public library, and I lied on my resume. I built a resume that was just a bunch of lies because I wanted a job. I
sure.
knew that working at DART and part-time at Hardee's wasn't going to, you know, make me amount to anything, and I needed to do something more than that. And so I when I was in the Navy, I had done a lot of I was going to be what they call a yeoman. So I knew how to type and I knew how to file and, you know, and I knew those type of things.
Skills.
So those skills that I had and so I embellished them on my resume and I got a job. And
wow.
I got a job and I think my first job I was making about $22,000 a year, which is a lot of money back then, by the way.
I was going to say, you must have felt like, holy shit, finally a break.
I was able to get my own apartment and, you know, and buy a car, and I remember working for this company and finally went to the boss and said, I've got to tell you something. And he was like, what? And I said, I lied on my resume. The pain that I had carried around because I had lied, even though by that point, by the way, I had already worked my way up the ladder. I had, when the boss would say to be there at 8, I'd be there at 7. When the boss said you could leave at 6, I would stay till 8. Because I knew that I didn't have education that was separating me, you know, that separated
from
me from
the other,
people.
Right, from anyone else.
I knew that I had amazing work ethics.
Wow.
And by amazing work ethics, I was going to succeed. And that's how my life has been. You know, I've been blessed to climb the corporate ladder and be an executive, all with zero education. I always laugh and tell people I can't tell the difference between there, and there. But what I can say is that I know what it means to work hard.
Yes.
I know what it means to come from the trenches and work your way up. And even now as an executive, I feel I get more respect from my employees because they know I've been there.
Yeah.
I've done that job. I didn't walk in with my degree and you handed me the corner office.
Right.
I worked my way up to get that office.
So when was this conversation with your boss? Were you in your late 20s?
I was in my mid-20s. I was about 25 years old.
Do they keep you employed at that point?
Oh, yes. They said, get back to work. He said, you know what? He said, Rob, you're one of the most honest people I've ever met. Get back to work.
Wow. Oh, my God. So this is, I think, what's fascinating, because it is interesting where people's lives go. And you talk a lot about choice, which I think is interesting, because lots of times I think, God, you know, I mean, you can see why people make not great choices because of the environment they were raised in. But you kind of have a different philosophy about that.
I have a totally different philosophy.
Yeah.
And I have people who don't agree with me at all, and that's okay, because life is about agreeing and disagreeing,
right?
You know, but I do believe that we have a choice in so many things, and we tend to blame things because of that choice, when if we really look at ourselves, we know what right choice to make. See, it's a lot easier to make the wrong choice. See, it was easy for me in my 20s to smoke weed and you know, and do drugs and drink, and
sure.
It was easier, and then it was easier for the escape to take pills, because I didn't want to deal with the pain, because the choice of having to confront that and deal with that, you know,
it's a lot, isn't it? When you deal with sadness or grief. I mean, I don't have anything on your level, but I did lose my father to cancer when I was in high school, and And it took me so long. It took me 10 years after that to really deal with that grief. And I went to therapy too. And my therapist, I love this saying. And she said, you know, what you resist persists.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter whether it's abuse in your childhood or death, or these things are really hard. And if you resist those feelings, they show up in other aspects of your life.
And they really do. And
so what were some aspects where it would show up? Like, did you have trouble with relationships?
I had trouble with relationships. I had trouble with believing anyone.
Everybody
had an underlying motive. As I said, I had done drugs. I lived a promiscuous life,
sure.
And it was all of those things that it kept coming out, and then not being genuine. I really was not genuine.
Really?
Oh my gosh.
God, that's hard to believe, Rob.
I was so not genuine.
Really?
I remember people would ask me where I was from and I would lie about where I was from. People would ask me about my past. I would lie about my past, I lied so much that I didn't know what the truth was a lot of times in my 20s, because I was so scared people were going to judge me. Mm. And I wanted to be better than what I was, because I wanted to be like those people, and so to me, that was really, really important. And, again, it was my early 30s that I finally, came to grips and became the person that I am today, and loving me.
That's my next question, is like, what was your turning point?
What was that moment? My turning point? I met Reese.
Oh my God. Oh my God, now we're all gonna cry.
I met Reese. I was 36. Mm. And I met Reese.
Oh my God.
And it was amazing. Amazing.
So you meet Reese, your husband. How long have you two been together?
13 years.
What was it about Reese? What was that?
He was genuine. Mm. He was nurturing. He is caring. He loves unconditionally. He is my rock. He is the reason I'm the man I am today. Every single moment, I could not be where I'm at today without him.
Wow.
When I was in the deepest and darkest well, not thinking that there was any escape to come out, he was the one who threw me the ladder.
Wow.
He's my everything.
God. You are that. I mean, I feel like your journey, right, was one of such hopelessness. And then, like, you were given this, like, the greatest light of all.
The light that shines like no other light I've ever had in my life,
When you first were with Reese, because I know your story, but, did you feel like, oh, my God, how is this man ever going to love me?
I tried everything for him not to love me. I mean, tried everything for him not to love me. And he just kept loving me more. And it was finally, and you just said that about, the resistance. And it was once I finally accepted that it was okay for me to be loved.
Ooh, yeah, that's big, isn't it?
It was huge.
It's big.
It was huge. That is when that weight came off. Even the years of therapy, it wasn't until I realized by feeling that love from him, and by the way, it was an unconditional love, because I tried everything for him not to love me, but he kept loving me more. That I felt was, wow, that's what unconditional love was about.
Did you guys break up and get back together?
Oh my gosh, I would go out on. He didn't date anybody else in the beginning, because he was too busy, and he was in college getting his master's, and he was all about his schoolwork, and he worked full time, and he. But I would go out on dates with other people and tell him and call him and be like, hey, this date wasn't good. You want to go grab a bite to eat? And he'd be like, okay, and so, but he would, and so yeah, I mean. mean, I even flew him to Vegas to break up with him. And because I was just like, because I knew I was falling in love with him. And so like 3 days into Vegas, I looked him and said, you know why I brought you here? And he was like, no. He was like, because, you know, he had a semester off of college or something. Right. And I was like, no, to break up with you. And he was like, what? And I said, yes. And I said, but the thing is I got to tell you, I love you. And that was the first time I told him I loved him. And he was so pissed and angry at me. He was like, you brought me here to break up with me? You're like, you bring someone to Vegas to break up with him. It's so funny. He still talks about that to this day. And like, I just got back from Vegas from a conference. And he was like, yeah. He's like, you know, good thing you didn't take me there. You were going to ask me for a divorce. And I was like, he's an amazing guy. Amazing. Amazing father. Yeah. Amazing husband. But most of all, he's an amazing person. And that to me speaks volumes. He is an amazing person.
So was it just like connecting with and being with Reese over and over again that then you began to be like, okay, I'm worthy of love? Or was it therapy?
It was both. It was a little bit of both. Okay. And I will tell you that every single time I would try not to be me, Reese would remind me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he would remind me, and he would say, you know, why are you putting on the airs, you know? And,
wow.
And I would say, listen, you know, we don't talk about that. And so, yeah.
And this is referring to all your past.
All my past. So at that particular moment, you know, Reese had already met a lot of my family. I have a biological sister who died of breast cancer. And when she died of breast cancer, she left me her 15 and 16-year-old daughters. And the 16-year-old daughter had a one-month-old baby. And so I ended up raising them. You know, Renee and Blake actually lived with Reese and I and our brownstone in D.C. And so Reese knew about my past. He'd asked enough questions and dove into enough of it that he knew about my past. And so, but it didn't matter to him. Now, mind you, he came from something totally different than me.
That's
you know,
what I heard
mean,
and read
his parents
that his family
just celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary.
Wow.
He is the youngest of two kids. He's got an older sister. They're very close. And he came from a church-going family in Kansas that, and very well-educated, you know, has a couple of degrees. He has his master's. And, you know, so different than me. Wow. So different than me.
I know. Opposites attract. And
opposites.
Like this amazing.
This truly tells you the Paula Abdul song that the opposites attract. Because I'm telling you, we are so opposite. And we're so opposite in so many ways that we complete each other.
Wow. It is such a true love story. And it just gets better when you guys, I love the story of, you know, you decided that, and this wasn't that long ago, what, 10 years ago?
Actually, almost, it'll be 9 years in January it will be 9 years this month that we started the journey of having kids. And so in July, it was July. We had come. I don't know if you remember Mayor Fitney, who used to be
yes,
the mayor of DC.
Sure.
So he was actually a friend of mine.
Okay.
And we were at his house for a party, and on a Friday night, I'll never forget it. Came home, probably had too many cocktails. the next morning, we're drinking coffee, and NBC Barbara Harrison comes on. And they were re-airing Wednesday's Child from the Wednesday before. They used to re-air it on Saturday mornings. And Reese looked at me and said, now explain to me why we're going through the paperwork of adopting a child overseas when look at these kids that are here in foster care.
And Wednesday's Child was this famous segment here in Washington, D.C. by Barbara Harrison, this reporter on NBC4, and they would feature kids every week who were looking to... They
needed to be adopted. So these were kids that are in foster homes and that they were looking for a forever home.
Right.
And Barbara Harrison started this 30 years ago, and she was the first. And she, since then, it's now national. I mean, there's not a state that I go to on business that I don't turn on the NBC News, and they have a Wednesday's Child. And it all started right here in our nation's capital with Barbara Harrison.
That's
amazing. You know, and watching that and re-saying to me, now explain to me again why we're adopting overseas. Because at that time, we'd already started our paperwork. We were looking to adopt overseas. Reese was at the ending of getting his master's. Okay. And one of the things that he promised me was the very first date we went on, the first thing I asked Reese was, do you want to be a father?
Wow.
That was the very first question I asked. And he looked at me and said, well, I hope to one day, but he's like, not until I get finish his master's. It was very important for him to get his finish his master's. And I said, okay, then we can probably go on a second date then. because I knew that I was going to be a dad. I knew that was my
calling.
Calling was to be a father, to show a child the love that I had never ever had, to show a child that they mattered.
Wow.
They mattered, you know? And so Reese had literally graduated from the Corcoran Art Institute in May, and by July, I'd already had every application out to adopt.
Jeez.
I mean, we were not going to waste any time. And so Reese said, why are we not looking to adopt locally through foster care? And I said, I told you about those kids. And he said, you were one of those kids. And he says, and look at you now.
Wow.
Yeah. It was crazy. You know, we'd been together for about four or five years at that point. And
that was part two. Thank you guys for listening. And thanks to Rob. I'm always so grateful when guests go so deep and really get underneath the feelings and the terrible stuff that happens to us, but also the light at the end of the tunnel. Also, if you guys could notice in the description of this podcast, there's a link, and I would love for you to fill out a survey so we could get some feedback on your podcast listening habits and what you want to hear more of. The link is survey.libsyn.com/heyfragepodcast. If you could just copy and paste that, it's just a couple of questions, it would really help us out. Thanks, guys. We'll see you next week. Phrase.